Hello, everybody, and thank you for tuning in to the Liberty Report. With me today is Jeff Dicey from Mises Institute, the president of the Mises Institute, a good friend of Liberty, somebody I've worked with for many years. Jeff, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks, Dr. Paul, for having me, and I'm sure you're not missing those traveling days to D.C. these days with everything going on up there.
You know, the country's gotten a lot worse, but let me tell you, traveling's gotten much worse, too, because I've been a stay-at-home person lately because, I made that one trip to, to Auburn for the Mises Institute. But I'm not going to do that very often, and yet I'm not very anxious to fly, and I haven't, none of our rich friends have said, you know, Ron, you need to travel more. I think I'm going to loan you my airplane. On occasion, that does happen, so we do make trips, but I know you get on the road, and you're still trying to keep up with that schedule with the Mises Institute, and I sort of like what you've done with those meetings. You don't think it's a good symbol to close shop and walk away. If at all possible, you continue to have your conferences, and that's what happened here in Lake Jackson. There were a lot of obstacles, but we still ended up with that conference for the Mises Institute, and that was we shared that with RPI, and it worked out real well. So I don't know of any problems that came from us having that meeting, and people came and they made their own judgment on how they should come, what they should wear. If they're allowed to wear their own clothes, they were allowed to decide what they want to put on their face.
Well, we've had a series of live events in 2020, and we're continuing them in 21, and people make their own decisions about whether they care to travel or whether they want to wear a mask or whether they want to be around other people. We haven't had anyone get sick or come down with anything as a result of these events. And of course, what we know now, which they've, I think, tried to underplay, is that asymptomatic people, in other words, people who don't have a fever or other symptoms, in effect, are not much transmitting this virus. So if you can simply have healthy people attend, people without a fever, I think you can feel pretty comfortable in having live events. But they don't want us doing that. There's no question about it.
You know, when you look at what we've learned here in these last several months, it really helps us within our argument, but I'm not sure we're any more persuasive. I think people are shifting an attitude because they're just sick and tired of it. But I think there's strong evidence that there's no proof that if you wear your mask, you're going to be safe or you're going to be more dangerous. So therefore, it comes closer to our position that some people are fearful, and some people have been told they can't change their mind, but if they want to wear their mask, they can, and they can be protected. They shouldn't fear us because we don't have a mask, and they shouldn't be telling us what to do. And you'd think that would be an easy sell, but still, people, the one attitude that's hard to understand is the people that go along with this, and then they come in sight of you, and you don't have a mask on. They feel this obligation to try to ridicule you and come and butt in, and they must be conditioned to think that we are dangerous, but this is a shortcoming. But the officials in our government, you know, with CDC and the different people and WHO, they've all helped terrorize the people into this. Makes it more difficult for us to offer, you know, a libertarian reassurance that you can still go out of your house. And matter of fact, lockdown's proven now that's caused more trouble because there's more people end up spreading of the virus when they're at home with a bunch of people than when people are out having visits and traveling around. So lockdown hasn't helped suppress the disease, and it certainly hasn't helped our economy. It's just a combination. So you'd think, hey, Jeff, and you know, I will always want to say, you know, we, the libertarian and conservatives and constitutionally, should take a little bit of blame for this. What's the matter? Why can't we sell this message? The message is so powerful. I would think we'd be more successful. But I say that to urge people to do it. And we do have success. And certainly the Mises Institute has had a lot of success. But I think you and I and others who work in the educational field are always looking for better ways to explain these issues and get people to, you know, understand what's going on, and then maybe they'll change their minds.
Well, we always need platforms to get our ideas out there. And in this day and age, especially with lockdowns, but in the digital age, those platforms are mostly online. They take the form of websites, of social media. And so that's really where the battle's being waged. And so that's what's so concerning about the last couple of weeks, as we've seen a lot of deplatforming, not only by social media outlets, you know, with respect to their own terms of service, but even by hosting companies, even by cloud providers like Amazon Web Services. So we've been really watching that. And we're sort of moving beyond the arguments about free speech or censorship, and we're trying to be proactive. But it's an issue that really goes back to the beginning of the internet itself.
Right. And although you've changed your targets a little bit and don't overdwell on censorship, but that's what the people are dwelling on right now, and the concern is an outcome of what has happened on the internet. And you're just suggesting, you know, there are alternatives. But you know, we'll hold off a minute on so many good suggestions that you have and what the Mises Institute has been doing. But what's your assessment on how we got into this mess? This is an old-fashioned censorship like the fascists have done and the communists have done. It's so blatant here. This is sort of a sinister thing, but it's still a mess, and they still have a lot of power. And when you think about it, you know, if you can just ignore some of the controversies with Trump for a minute, it's pretty amazing that all of a sudden they say to Trump, you can't do this, you can't do that, and close them down. It's tremendous censorship. How do you think we got here? Is it the fault of the corporations, or the individuals, or is it the fault of the government setting the conditions for this to develop?
Well, I think there's definitely an unholy alliance here between big tech and big government. There's no question about that. But more importantly, really, since the internet first became viable for average people, governments around the world have always wanted to control this. I mean, the idea that individuals could bypass governments and spread information, especially across borders, I think has always been troubling to them. And if you layer it on top of that desire by governments to control information, there's also been the desire to control things like pornography. So when we look at the early days of the internet, we look at old-fashioned providers like AOL or search engines like AltaVista, you know, it was a bit of the Wild West, I'm sure in some senses, but when the Communications Decency Act of 1996 was passed, which now gives us this infamous Section 230, you know, that was really a couple of different bills. There were some people in the Senate trying to control pornography, hence the name of the bill itself, Decency Act. Nothing decent about things the Senate does. But then there were also more libertarian voices, like the former Chris Cox, whom you served with in Congress, arguing that these providers shouldn't be required to monitor the content on their platforms, and they shouldn't be held liable for the content that individuals post. And we can understand this easily. For example, if two criminals engage in a conspiracy to kill someone, and they're on the phone using AT&T's network to do so, nobody would say, well, AT&T ought to be indicted as a co-conspirator. So we understand the idea that content providers should be neutral. But so the Communications Decency Act, Section 230, what that came along and basically preempted states from entertaining lawsuits against these companies. So it's a legal preemption doctrine. And as a result of that, not only ISPs, but also social media companies have been supported by the courts when it comes to interpreting this section, and have been allowed to exercise some editorial control. They've been allowed to ban users, to eliminate certain content, to put flags on certain content. So we've entered into an era where these companies are not just acting as neutral carriers or platforms like a phone company, but they're exercising some control. And I generally agree with the sentiments and the objectives behind Section 230. I'm not in a rush to force companies to regulate or to use statutory power of Congress to regulate these companies. But nonetheless, we do have an environment today where they sure look like they're acting more like the New York Times than the phone company.
Right, and I think 230 was well-intended. They tried to get a bipartisan support with it, but the libertarian principle is just stay out of it, you know, and there's other ways to go with it. But their intent was to try to make sure if there was less liability of the companies, then more people should have access, and they would increase the ability of people to use the internet. But I don't know if that ever really happened, but it looks like now it's doing exactly the opposite. It's being used to exclude. You know, I personally know about that. They're trying to exclude me, you know, because of these rules. But I really agree with your caution about, you know, watch out for the regulations. They sometimes backfire. And when you look at anything in Washington, as you'll probably recall, that there was always times, whether it was the Patriot Act or some other security agent, we have to have reform. And when they talk about reform, watch out. So that's why I fear this whole thing. Well, everybody now is very nervous about 230. So we need, you know, a bipartisan commission to reform this. And even though there might be a reform that could, you know, make the regulation a little better, it's very risky business. I think most reforms in Washington lead to more trouble because the people who want more government usually get in charge of the reforms, but it will always be couched in terms of more freedom and solving a problem. But too often we've seen the conditions get much worse rather than anything getting reformed.
Well, yeah, certainly with the current makeup of Congress and the White House, I'm very concerned about what they might do. And look, 1996, when the CDA was passed, that might as well be 1896 by the way things are moving so rapidly. And I mentioned Chris Cox was one of the co-authors of Section 230. There was also a liberal senator named Ron Wyden from Oregon, who is the co-author of that. So there was actually still a free speech libertarian sentiment on the left as recently as 1996. Now, today, that sentiment is completely gone. The left is clamoring for censorship. The left is praising deplatforming. The left is actively looking to silence and eliminate conservative voices from the social media sphere in particular, but also from hosting companies, from banking, from payment gateways like credit cards and PayPal. So it's really a radically more authoritarian climate in Washington, D.C. today than even just 25 years ago. And so those old happy impulses towards letting the internet develop with a relatively unregulated environment, that's long gone. And I fear also that some of those tech pioneers, the people in the ostensible private sector themselves, have lost their libertarian spirit. Companies like Microsoft used to boast that they didn't have lobbyists in Washington. And of course, now we see the CEOs of Twitter and Facebook actively working with governments and quasi-governmental NGOs to determine what content's okay. And that's obviously very frightening. And I'm going to suggest, actually, a speech which was delivered at our event in Texas near your home just a couple of months back by a professor named Michael Rechtenwald. Many of you might know him from his infamous ousting at NYU. And he delivered a talk called The Google Election. And if you go back and look at that at the Mises.org website, you'll see that the origins of companies like Google are not as private sector as you might think. So while virtually all companies and corporations in the United States are somewhat involved with government, whether they want to be or not, it's particularly, I think, getting harder and harder to view the big tech companies in this country as purely private entities.
You know, Jeff, I know you're not here and I don't have you here to solicit some funds from our viewers and saying, yes, we need some funds because we want to hire the very best lobbyists to go to Washington and compete with those billionaires. Well, we know that isn't a very good tactic. But eventually, it's popular sentiments that are important. And sometimes I look at what's happening right now in popular sentiments. You know, when they close down somebody's websites and things like that. You know, there's nothing that guarantees the value of these countries. People do resist and walk away. So there's a market function there. But there's so many things that can be done, and that's what I really want to talk about. There's other ways to do it without sacrificing principles and what is available, because we're not at the point where if we do something immediate, then the next day we're arrested. But people fear that. But there are things, and you go through a list of the different things that the Mises Institute have done to protect it. And we've talked about that a lot with our organization. Where can this be preserved? Even though we're in the early years of us doing this program, I didn't understand much of the technology, but I understood the politics of it all. You know, we could be threatened. Where are we going to put it? How can we do this? How can we compete? And I guess Parler was a form of competition, but you know, that's up in the air right now. So tell us a little bit about this, and how long would you say the Mises Institute had that as a specific project? Has it just been incremental and you'd throw out an idea 5 years ago, or did somebody really sit down and say, you know, we have to have a strategy and we have to find out the alternatives we have to try to preserve our ability to get our message out?
Well, no, for us, it's been an ongoing project. And in many senses, the Mises Institute was founded back in the 80s on the concept of build your own platform, because there weren't a lot of outlets for Austrian economics and what we would consider sound economics. So really, since the beginning, because we've been radically anti-state, radically anti-Fed, radically pro-property, pro-secession, pro-decentralization. We've always been in the crosshairs of mainstream media, potentially government regulators, certainly other advocacy organizations in and outside of D.C. So we've always had that mentality that people are coming for us. And I think that's helped us in the current age, because we assume if you can say we need to regulate hateful speech or incitement to violence, you know, and you go from that standard to start saying, well, we also need to regulate disinformation about COVID. Well, it's not much more of a leap to say, well, we also need to regulate disinformation about the Fed or something else. So we operate on the assumption that platforms like Facebook and Twitter and YouTube may eventually deplatform us. We operate on the assumption that our internet service provider, our web hosting companies may someday pull the switch on us. So we have standbys of our website hosted in foreign jurisdictions. We've actively secured our name on all the potential social media sites. We've taken a lot of steps to make sure that that our website can be accessed via just normal searches or via your own browser. We're not overly reliant on social media to drive traffic to our site. We've diversified ourselves with banking when it comes to our money and our funds, because we're obviously very, very worried. We've seen some gun companies, for example, gun manufacturers, be denied banking services. So I don't want to get too deep into the kind of steps we've taken to protect ourselves. But, you know, for a lot of years before the digital era, our organization operated using old-fashioned snail mail and video cassettes and physical books. And I would hate to have to go back to that era, because the digital world has been such a democratizing force, such a leveling force between small, less influential voices like those of us in the libertarian sphere and big, powerful voices like the two parties and the mainstream media. And so we've been able to get information to people all over the world instantaneously, virtually free. All the great books are out there now for free. So this has been, you know, a huge leveling force for us. And if we ever lost the ability to communicate digitally, that would be a huge blow to us. But it wouldn't be a fatal blow, because we've taken steps to make sure we could still operate.
Jeff, have you had any feedback from your supporters or the pretend supporters and saying, sounds good, but it's too theoretical, you can't do that, you have to fight these people with the same tactics they have. You got to be much firmer. Do you get that, or do they know exactly where you stand and that the process is not to compromise in any way? But it seems like, you know, you certainly would permit discussion of it, you know, and say, well, maybe if we can't stop a hearing, to modify it and to change it, that you couldn't make a statement and say, well, if you go and do this and you want to change something, if you just strike these one words, if somebody was proposing that, it seems like I wouldn't be much interested in that, because I'm with you on this thing. We need to be total. But I'm just interested in the politics of it, whether you had much feedback with people saying, hey, you guys are too tough. You're never going to get anything. You got to get the right people in the right committees in order to achieve anything.
Well, if we wanted to moderate the message, we wouldn't really be the Mises Institute. So we're not interested in that particularly. We're not interested in political candidates. But what you have to understand is, when it comes to trying to find some sort of peaceable relationship with, let's say, hosting companies or ISPs or social media providers, look, things are changing so radically that what was safe 2 or 3 years ago isn't safe today. So what, you know, who knows what won't be safe in 2 or 3 more years? And honestly, you can talk about whether they're really private companies. You can talk about censorship or First Amendment, which of course doesn't apply to private companies. You can talk about Section 230. You can talk about all kinds of things. But at the end of the day, if a big company deplatforms you or shuts you down in some way, your only real recourse is a lawsuit. Okay, and how long is that going to take, and what's the likelihood of succeeding, and how much money will that take? And in the meantime, will you still be silent? So it seems to us that the better approach with our time and money is to try to go around these potential deplatformers and find our own alternative platforms, which we've in certain ways been doing since the 80s, because we've always done an end run around academia, around mainstream media, the academic orthodoxy in economics. So we've been doing that since day one, and now we're just finding other ways. And I mean, you know this better than most. There's always a market for information. There's always a way for information to flow. And even in the worst setting, we think of lockdowns. I mean, to me, that conjures up prison. Even in prison, The inmates manage to communicate with each other in a myriad ways. So, you know, now that we have global digital apparatus, it's going to be awfully hard to completely shut everything down. And I think we have to move forward optimistically with that in mind and say, well, of course there are going to be obstacles. Of course there are enemies of liberty, because they're the beneficiaries of liberty. But the underlying ideology, the impulse towards freedom, which includes free communication and speech, is not so easily quashed. And for that reason, I'm actually quite optimistic about a highly decentralized future, where we don't have these huge gatekeepers like Google Search or Amazon Web Services or Facebook and Twitter and Instagram as the only big 800-pound gorillas in social media. So I'm actually quite optimistic.
Well, I think there's, and I always want to maintain being optimistic, and I am. And one of the points I make is that conditions change rapidly. A month from now, things may be a lot different socially. The social order may be disrupted. Economically, you know, that's a time bomb. That may change. And this is the reason I so strongly support the Mises Institute, is they're doing the work of preservation and innovation and showing that it's available, because ideas really is, from my viewpoint, is the only thing that really counts. And those ideas have to be known to thought leaders, and they have to be known by the general public. And I think when the mess really comes about, there's information out there, and I think it's so important that you have prepared to keep it under all circumstances, because that's what will provide the answers. But I think the I think the conditions are going to be such that they'll have to look for other answers other than we will be moving so rapidly toward Venezuela or something like that. And I just have a hard time believing that we're that bad off. And then there's days I believe we are. but I also end up with the same thing. Well, you have to do your best. I think, you know, ideas have consequences. And a truly great idea whose time has come, I think it will work. And I think that's why we work in this area. So I think for all the money spent in Washington, all the power mongering and all this thing that the trillionaires and the billionaires, they have created a situation that is so bad that, 1% of the population owns everything. And the political system is in such shambles. But we need to make sure that this message gets out. And Jeff, that's why I am so anxious you keep that message going, which I'm sure you will. And I'm so pleased with that because I was sort of around in the 1980s when Lou was getting this organization started. So, Jeff, I think that the optimism is important. The precise answer to the programs are important. And I think they will seek it out because the good people probably have already rejected or left, you know, the university system that has done nothing but preach authoritarianism. And I keep thinking about, well, when I wonder about this, I wonder how many, and I think I've asked Lou this question once in a while, how many people do you think you've influenced that have gotten into education that has gone through, you know, the education that's available with the Mises Institute? And quite frankly, I don't think you probably do know. Nobody knows. I keep wondering, I talk to a lot of people, but I don't think, you know, I didn't have crowds like Trump or anybody else. But it's amazing as I go around the country, I meet young people who were in college when I talked before that are energetic and enthusiastic about it. And that really gives me some enthusiasm too. So that's why, Jeff, I think what you're doing is very great. So tell us about how you're going to keep this going and make sure that we can have a dent in this, because I think our views are going to be very necessary very soon.
Well, I'll tell you what, with the digital revolution and all the resources these young people have now, I mean, I meet some of these kids who are maybe 20 years old, and they're much better read than I was at 20. They've read Mises and Rothbard, you know, in their late teens or early 20s. I didn't start reading that stuff till maybe my mid-20s, and I had to go procure it physically, you know. So that's been a huge advantage, and of course, we want to keep that going. We ask people to come to Mises.org, and we have an events page there if you want to see whether we're scheduled to be somewhere near you in 2021. We hope that you'll follow us for the time being anyway on social media platforms like Facebook and Twitter. And if these ideas interest you and you'd like to learn a little bit more about the economics end of it as opposed to the more broad libertarian sphere, then I think we'd be a great resource for you.
Very good, Jeff, and I want to thank you very much for being with us today, and I hope all our viewers will go to your website, but I'm pretty sure that most of our viewers know about the Mises Institute, but the job is ahead, and I see that part of our position is that we represent a remnant. I don't think they ever destroy, even when they're sound religious issues and beliefs or whether they're economic beliefs, there's always going to be a remnant that will maintain it. But not only has the Mises Institute maintained it, and it's helped the remnant to grow, and that's what is important. So I think that there's reason to be optimistic, and that we have to keep it going, though, because the opportunities are going to be there, and there's going to be a necessity for us to do something different than what this country is doing right now. I want to thank everybody for tuning in today to the Liberty Report. Please come back soon.